I am pleased to present an audio recording of the workshop on the introduction to the Yoga Sutras that I presented on March 18th, 2017. This is an ongoing monthly series, and in this session, we began the discussion of kleshas. Kleshas are the afflictions or the sufferings that we go through. I hope you will enjoy this presentation, and I would love to hear your feedback. Again, just a quick recap of what we've done. In the first few sessions, we discussed the basic definition of yoga. That was all from chapter 1 of the Yoga Sutras. The definition of yoga, an introduction to the 5 vrittis, as they are called. There are 5 of them. And then we went through the concept of abhyasa, or practice, and vairagya, which is detachment or non-attachment. So that was a part of the chapter first that we did. And then we, from there on, we jumped to the 8 limbs of yoga. And that's where we spent our, you know, most of the time in the last 6 to 8 months, I think, on going through the 8 limbs of yoga. But we spent almost like 3 sessions on meditation, finally, in the last 3 sessions. Okay, that's the last of the 8 limbs, meditation and samadhi. Okay, those are the last limbs. So that kind of gets us into the very practical aspect of yoga, which is how to attain the objective of yoga, which is to calm the mind. And Patanjali says, if you practice these 8 limbs of yoga, it will get you there. Okay, so that's why we spent a lot of time. And from today on, we'll focus on the concepts presented in chapter 2, which is a philosophical understanding of the concept of klesha. Klesha is all the suffering, afflictions, pains that we go through. Then it goes into the theory of karma and the results of your karma and actions, etc., how they manifest in this life or future lives. And then he gets into the very essence of the underlying philosophy of yoga, which is based on the Sankhya philosophy. On the Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya. S-A-N-K-H-Y-A. And there are a few sutras in the chapter 2 which kind of really give a very condensed version of the Sankhya philosophy, because the whole of Patanjali's yoga is based on that philosophy. So it's a beautiful description at a, you know, brief level, but very beautiful description of the Sankhya philosophy. Okay, and then of course goes into the reason why we have this suffering, and finally that's where he leads into the description of the 8 limbs of yoga as to the main means of eliminating this suffering. Okay, so we did the elimination first, but now we're going to understand what the suffering is and why it is there. So going backwards, I think that makes a lot of sense, because I really want to introduce the practical aspects first. Start the practice and then understand the underlying reasons why we need all that. Okay? So, in chapter 2, he starts out by this. So, I'm going to keep sliding through these slides here. Basically, what I've written here is the same thing that I just went through. The definition of yoga, 5 types of vrittis and etc., mean to control the vrittis and all that. That's what I just mentioned. And from here on, it is the problem is I need to be sitting next to it. Otherwise I cannot slide it. Okay, let me just move my chair here. Okay, so see, one second. The reason why I want this version is because I have this in Sanskrit also, which for me it's much easier to read than the English. Okay. All right. So, it starts by defining what he calls the Kriya Yoga. Kriya literally means action. Okay, so the yoga of action, which essentially says that, you know, you need these three parts, three activities as the Kriya Yoga. And these are the same as you will recognize from the five, these are the three from the five Niyamas. Okay, these are, so what we have been doing in the past is, remember, we read the Sutra in Sanskrit, so you'll repeat after me, and then we'll go through the meaning. So it is Tapa. Swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhanani. Tapas Swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhanani. Kriya Yoga. Okay. Yeah, that's good. So, Tapas Swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhana, they are a part of the five Niyamas also. But he has isolated these three as a composite element, which he calls Kriya Yoga. Okay? So, the reason he has done this is because he's going to explain that in the next sutra, why he has done that. Okay? So, what is tapaha? What is tapas? You remember that from the five Niyamas? To burn. But what are we burning here? What's tapas is the most common translation is austerity. You know, you put your body and mind through some
challenge,
measured difficulty, so to say, not unmeasured. You know, and that helps you make the body. That's what the burning is, right? When you put yourself through some challenging situation, you burn your karmas that way. And you burn all the dross that you have in the body. So, tapas is things like, you know, telling yourself, okay, I'm going to give up food for such an amount of time, or I'm to give up watching emails for such an amount of time, or go myself through a phone fast, email fast, and all those things, right? So that's tapas. I will give up TV, or I'll give up coffee for a week. That's part of tapas. Or I'll get up every morning at 4 o'clock and do my yoga asana practice. You know, that's tapas. Things like that. Or I'll sit in meditation for 2 hours, undistracted. That's tapas. Okay? So something that you decide to do, which is far and beyond your normal stuff that you do, that's called tapas. Swadhyaya, what is swadhyaya?
Self-study.
And self-study usually translates into two things in most commentaries. One is you study the ancient scriptures. Okay, scriptures implying texts which are known to contain the ultimate truth of life. In the Indian context, these are the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, Yoga Sutras and some of the other philosophical texts that we have, they are supposed to contain the truth of life, and they are considered the scriptures. So study of these scriptures is called Swadhyaya. And through that study, once we understand the nature of the reality that we are looking for, okay, then you apply that to your own self and study yourself. Understand, go deeper into yourself and try to understand who you are. So my job will be to go deeper into myself to really try to remove all that clutter that I have so I can take a peep at myself.
Is that different than self-awareness?
Awareness comes as a result of this study, basically. Yeah.
But it's more taking the principles and applying it.
Once you are more aware of who you are, then you are better, more self-aware then. Otherwise, our awareness is also cluttered by our ego. Okay, so it's the job of this study and this self-analysis to remove the negative impact of the ego so we can go into deeper into ourselves for a better analysis of who we are. So that is self-study. And then Ishvara Pranidhana, what does that mean? Devotion, a sense of ego-less surrender to a higher power, you can say, if you want to look at it that way. Ishvara has been, now we spent a fair amount of time in discussing Ishvara actually. We spent almost 2 full sessions trying to understand what Ishvara is all about. And Ishvara has been defined as a very special entity in the Yoga Sutras, okay? And it is now, you know, the way we understand it is Ishvara is at a higher pedestal, so to say, than us. All right, so we want to surrender ourselves to that entity, to that reality called Ishvara. And the most common or the most closest translation in English would be God. But that's not what Patanjali talks about. He doesn't bring in the word God there. He doesn't bring in the equivalent of that in Sanskrit. Ishvara has been defined very specially by him. Okay, so what he's saying is that these three constitute what he calls Kriya Yoga. Okay? So if you look at these individually, the austerity or the tapas is related to your willpower. You know, because we are saying, okay, I'm going to give up this and this, this and that for some time, or I'm going to take this on for some time, I'm going to practice meditation for some time. That requires a lot of willpower. Okay. So that's the action part, sort of the, you can call it in the language of Bhagavad Gita, that will be treated as karma yoga. You're doing something, whether it's physical or mental, and it's karma yoga. And it involves the will, okay? So that's the Ichha Shakti, as it's called in Sanskrit. Ichha Shakti, that's will. Okay, so that's the austerity part. Then the self-study is more analytical and synthetic in its nature. So we are analyzing and synthesizing stuff about ourselves. So it's very analytical in that sense. So that is a part of what in Bhagavad Gita is called the Jnana Yoga, or the Yoga of Knowledge. Because this is a study which we use the intellect to study it, but then we let the intellect go away. We don't want to keep the intellect in the picture once we have done the study. So it's the self-study through the understanding of scriptures, which requires a lot of intellectual depth so we can understand those concepts. So it's a part of Jnana Yoga. Okay? And then finally, surrender to Ishvara, or total devotion to Ishvara, is a part of the Bhakti Yoga, as it's called. Okay, Bhakti is devotion. Okay, are you all familiar with the Bhagavad Gita? And so those concepts of Bhakti, Bhakti Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Karma Yoga, and Jnana Yoga, and the Dhyana Yoga, they're all concepts there. So they relate to those concepts here. Okay, and then that is the Kriya Yoga, and as I said, now he tells us why you need Kriya Yoga. Okay? So that's the reason why you need Kriya Yoga. And what he's saying is, Samadhi, Bhavanartha, Klesha, Tanukaranartha, Cha. So Cha is and, okay. In English we use and in the middle. In Sanskrit, and is used always at the end.
The word and is cha.
Cha. Just C-H-A, so to say. Okay. So, samadhi bhavanartha. So, let's do this individual now. Samadhi bhavanartha.
Samadhi bhavanartha.
Klesha tanu karanartha.
Klesha tanu karanartha.
Cha. All right. So, what does that mean now? Samadhi, we know what samadhi is. Okay. Samadhi bhavana. What is bhavana? What's bhavana?
It says
some kind of feeling.
Feeling, essence, you know, awareness or something like that. Okay, samadhi bhavanarth. So for the purpose of getting the bhavana of samadhi, I'm translating the Sanskrit words into English phrase, for artha means for the purpose of. So the for the purpose of attaining the bhavana of samadhi, bhavana is to get a feel for it, to get an essence of what that samadhi is. Okay, to get an understanding of that samadhi. So that is one purpose of the Kriya Yoga. Okay? That's what he's referring to. So the Kriya Yoga, one purpose is to attain an essence or the feel for samadhi. And the other purpose is, that's why that cha is at the end. And the other purpose is klesha tanu karana. Now, klesha is what? Obstacles. Klesha, not the obstacles. Klesha are the actual suffering. Okay? Klesha is the actual suffering, the afflictions that we go through in life, all the stresses and strains that we go through in life. That's klesha. And tanu karana means?
Body.
No, tanu is what? The word tanu means narrow. Something, when you start diminishing something, it becomes narrow and narrow.
The sense of removing?
Removing. Okay. In fact, you know, one of the names for Indian women is Tanu. It means the woman with a very narrow waist. So it's a beautiful woman. It's called Tanu. That's why many women are named Tanu. Tanuja, Tanushri, you know, all these very, very common names in India. So kind of an extended meaning of Tanu is a beautiful woman. But literal meaning is Tanu is something that's narrow and that's been shrinking down, okay. So, klesha tanu karana. Karana means to do. Okay, so to diminish the kleshas. Okay, so one purpose is to get you close to samadhi, in a sense, of this kriya yoga. And the second purpose is to diminish your kleshas. They go hand in hand. Samadhi can be attained only when you have no kleshas. Okay? So, they work together basically. Yeah? So we get rid of these kleshas, or at least diminish their influence on us, and then we slowly move toward samadhi. Alright? Now, he doesn't say that you will attain samadhi, not necessarily. He says samadhi bhavana. That means you'll get a feel for it. So it's getting going in that direction. Okay, so that's the Kriya Yoga. And here I sort of tried to show it in a little bit of a picture format. What I've shown here is that, you know, we talk of this whole being as a complex of mind, body, intellect and the senses, etc. So here on one side I have the mind. Oops. Oh. Okay. So, on one side, I have the mind, then the intellect, and then the five senses, etc. So there are five senses coming this way, and I have shown the organs of action. Remember we talked about the organs of action and five senses and all that. This is a part of the 23 elements. Everyone remember the 23 elements? No? Let's go through that. That's a very, you know, it's always good to remember those 23 elements. What are the 23 elements? We've done it pretty much every time. Five senses. Well, start with the highest one first. At the highest level, it is the intellect.
Intellect, mind.
Buddhi. Buddhi is the intellect, which is at the highest level. Then the mind. Ego, number three.
Sense perceptions.
Sense organs.
Organs of action.
Huh?
Organs of reproduction?
No, those are the organs of action. One of the organs of action are the organs of reproduction.
Five elements.
So the 23 are five elements, which are the earth, water, air, ether and space. I mean, whatever, they're five, okay? Then five sense perceptions, sense of smell, taste, etc. And then five organs which are associated, one with each of these five senses. Ear for the hearing, nose for the smell, etc. And then five organs of action. Legs, hands, tongue for speech. Then organs of elimination and organs of reproduction. Five of those. That makes us 20. Then ego, mind and the intellect. Okay? So those are the 23 elements that we are composite of. Now, what I've shown here is the same thing, mind, intellect, etc. And then ego is another one in that same complex. Mind, ego, intellect, we remember we said that. Memory is a part of, it's a common element. Memory is used by all of them. Okay? Ego uses the memory, the intellect uses the memory, the mind uses the memory, etc., etc. Okay? And then, of course, there is a little dividing line, and then there is the soul, or the purusha, beyond that. Okay, so that's what I've shown here. Alright. So, the discriminating wisdom arises an awareness of separation between self and the that's the problem. I don't know. How do you reduce the size? Let's see. Not going to work. I need to redo these slides someday. See, what happened was, I did these slides in PowerPoint. Okay? And then, recently I had to get this PC rebuilt. It got busted, and it was still under warranty, so they paid for it, fortunately. But in the process, I lost Microsoft software, all the Office software. Now I don't want to pay for it. So, I'm using this software called OpenOffice. Okay, but then it messes up the formatting of the whole process. So now, this is because I'm using OpenOffice and trying to open an Excel spreadsheet, my PowerPoint presentation. I cannot control the size. So I have to redo the whole thing. That's why you'll be seeing some part missing. But that's okay. Okay. So for the purpose of getting close to samadhi and getting rid of the kleshas or diminishing the influence of the kleshas. That's the purpose of Kriya Yoga. And remember Kriya Yoga was tapas, swadhyaya and Ishvara Pranidhana. Very good. Now he is trying to get into the five kleshas one by one. Alright. What's the first one? Avidya. Next one? Asmita. Third? Raga. Fourth? Dvesha. And fifth one? Abhinivesha. So, avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. These are the five kleshaha. Klesha. Five kleshas. Alright. Avidya is ignorance. And we'll get into the definition of each one of these. Avidya literally means ignorance. Asmita means ego. Okay. Then raga is
attachment.
Dvesha is
aversion,
hatred, you know, dislike, etc. That's dvesha, animosity. That is dvesha. And abhinivesha is fear of death. That's
Is there a different way to put that? But it's I don't know.
Yeah, the literal meaning of abhinivesha is to try and maintain status quo. That's the literal meaning. Okay, try and maintain status quo, which means we generally don't like change. And it's the fear of change, you can say, which is abhinivesha.
Of all kinds of changes,
but obviously the ultimate change is the change which results in death. So that's why they say it is commonly translated as the fear of death or the desire to cling to life because we do not want change. Okay. It comes from the root word wish, wishes to enter. Then you add the prefix ni, nivish, nivish is to stay. Then you add another prefix called abhi, abhinivesh, which means to stay put, don't do anything, don't change anything, maintain status quo. So, you know, that's how the Sanskrit words are kind of derived, alright? Alright. So these are the five kleshas. Oh. I've written the word obstacle, that's wrong. I'm not sure where I got that translation. Klesha is not obstacle. Klesha is afflictions.
I think it's a common translation. I've seen it put many
times. It's not right. In my understanding, that's not right. They're not obstacles. Klesha is, no, it's not. From Sanskrit point of view, that's not an obstacle. So what are these kleshas? So the five kleshas are avidya, asmita, etc. We just said that. Again, just to kind of elaborate on the Sanskrit phraseology, avidya, it's the vidya, with a prefix a. Okay, a negates anything. So vidya is knowledge, avidya is lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, ignorance. Same thing with asmita. Asmi means I am, and asmita is the essence of I am, which is I am-ness. Okay. Now here, see, asmita has two meanings. If you remember, in the first chapter, we talked about asmita as one of the samadhis, one of these samadhis based on that pure sense of I am. So when I have understood the essence of who I am, then I can complete the sentence by saying I am, period. That's a full sentence. That's called asmita. That means I have understood who I am, and all it is I exist, I am. That's the pure essence of asmita. That's not the sense being used here. Here, what's the sense of asmita here? I am, you need something else after that, then you add the period. I am good, period. I am bad, period. I am ignorant, period. I am the father, I am the mother, I am so and so. I am rich, I am poor, I am stupid, I am intelligent. That's the sense being used here. That's ego. Meaning is the same, asmita. In the first chapter, it is used in a positive sense. In the second chapter, it's used in a negative sense. Same word. It derives from the same word, asmi. Asmi means I am. Okay? Then raga. Raga comes from the root word, ranj, which means to color something. Raga is attachment, or coloring my own ego with something that I like or dislike. That's how this word is arrived at. Raga, attachment. Then dvesha, that's straightforward, dvish, which comes from dvish, which means to have animosity, etc. Hate, dislike. And I just explained abhinivesha. So that's the...
If someone is a very hateful person,
right,
very predominant in their personality, how do they go about to change that?
How do they go about... Changing happens only by understanding our true reality, right? That's the whole purpose of this whole chapter, of chapter 2, is to understand who I am in reality. Who, you know, when you say you hates, one who hates everybody, one who is very dominant, or one who is controlling everything, that's all based on the ego, that asmita that he's talking about. And that's what we are coming to. You know, this whole thing is discussion of why this thing, that thing happens. It's okay. And, it's all based on the, it starts with avidya. Well, let's go through these. I think your question will probably be answered at least partially, and then we'll come back to it. Okay? And now, what it says is, okay, let's read the Sanskrit first. Avidya, kshetram, uttaresham, prasupta, tanu, vichinna, udaranam. Okay, so that's the whole definition of avidya. So, avidya kshetram uttaresham.
Avidya kshetram uttaresham.
Prasupta tanu vichinna.
Prasupta tanu vichinna.
Udaranam.
Udaranam.
Alright, so that's the whole definition of avidya. The first part is that it is the field kshetram. Field means it's the essence of something. Uttaresham. Uttaresham is what follow. What are the following things? Asmita, raga, dvesha, etc. Alright? So, avidya basically represents the mother of all these other four. That's what it means. Alright? It encompasses everything else. It's the mother. It's the root cause of everything else. Avidya.
Ignorance.
Alright? So, that's what causes all this trouble. Okay? But then it can also be prasupta. Prasupta means it is totally hidden. Alright? It's very dormant. And tanu is, again, that tanu, same word tanu, narrow. It's feeble, it's weak, it's not fully expanded. Tanu. Vichinna. Vichinna means it is, comes and goes, so to say. Sometimes it is feeble, sometimes it is hot, sometimes it's cold, etc. That's vichinna. Okay? The translation that I have from, I have this from this book actually, all my translations. Some of them are not very accurate, but that's okay. Alright, so he has translated intercepted. Okay. Vichinna means?
Actually, it's a big thing distorted into a small, small, that is called vichinna, actually.
Vichinna, it could be that, or vichinna can also mean it is weak at one point, it is little stronger at the other point. That's vichinna. The other meaning is something that you take solid and then you break it into pieces, that's also vichinna. Different meanings in different concept, in different contexts. Okay, and then udarana means it's there, active, it's fully sustained at this point. Okay, so what it means is that this avidya, this ignorance can be very deeply hidden in us, can be feeble, can be coming and going, and then it could be fully dominant. That's what it basically means. Alright? So that's the whole concept of avidya. And this is the definition of avidya now. What is the real definition of avidya? Okay, so what is the definition here? Let's read this. Anitya,
Anitya.
Ashuddhi,
Ashuddhi.
Dukha,
Dukha.
Anatmasu.
Anatmasu.
So, anitya, ashuchi, dukha, anatmasu.
Anitya, ashuchi,
ashuchi.
Ashuchi.
Dukha,
dukha.
Anatmasu. Anatmasu. Nitya,
nitya.
Shuchi.
Shuchi,
sukha,
sukha.
Atmakhyatihi,
atmakhyatihi.
Vidya. Vidya, avidya. Avidya. Okay? So that's the definition of avidya, that it is, what is nitya? Nitya is something that is permanent. Okay, nitya is something that stays forever. When you add the prefix a, it becomes impermanent. So, looking at something that is permanent and thinking of it as impermanent and vice versa. That's the first part. Anitya, nitya. Ashuchi, what is shuchi?
Cleanliness,
shuchi. Pure, clean. Something which is pure or something which is impure and you think of it as pure. Okay? Something that is impermanent, you think of it as permanent. What are the common examples of that?
Life.
Life, right? Life. We always think of life as, oh, nothing is going to happen to me, but it is very, very, like in Sanskrit we say kshana bhangura, that means it can be destroyed in a second. Kshana. Right? Everything, the physical body, the mind, we think of them as permanent and we think of them as, you know, never everlasting, but it's not. And that's the avidya part. Alright? That's the regarding impermanent as permanent, then impure as pure. What's a good example of that?
You think watching TV is healthy for you.
Right. Yeah, right, right. Right. I mean, we eat food, all kinds of food, which is probably not good for us, but we think it's very good for us. We don't know sometimes.
Tastes good.
This whole body, for example. Look at this body. Ever think of what comes out of this body? Everything that comes out of the body is filth, pure, stinky filth. That means everything inside us is completely filth. Everything. And guess what? We think the body is the most beautiful thing on earth. Right? It's just this upper coating which you keep making it more and more, you know, powder, this, that, and polish it here, polish it there. You take a millimeter deep inside there. It's a disaster there. So that's what we say. Taking something that is so impure and disgusting inside, you know, to be the most beautiful thing. And we spend $1 billion every year, many billions of dollars in maintaining it that way. Okay. So that's ashuchi dukham. So what is painful, We take that as something which is very pleasant, as very comfort-giving. Examples, everything, right? What's a good example of treating something that is so painful, and then we think of it as pleasant?
Overexertion, physical overexertion, like thinking that that is pleasant, doing too much, like more than what your body is capable of.
Right.
Greedy for more money, stuff like thinking like it's having money is a pleasure. I don't understand. Maybe an example.
What else? Eating?
Eating too much, everybody.
Everybody eats too much, thinking that it is very pleasant.
Yeah.
Eating ice cream, tons of ice cream, which is very pleasant, but it's eventually very painful. Right? Anyway, and then anatma is not the self. Okay, thinking of that as the self. That's the ultimate. Yes. We're taking this whole thing as ourself, which is not true. Okay, so that's the example of non-self for self. So, I have given some examples here. So instead of saying that I have a headache, I just thought of it. Instead of saying I have a headache, if we say, my head hurts. Okay. Then you're isolating yourself from the head. It's not you. I don't have the headache. My head had the headache. I'm detaching myself just by making that statement from my physical being.
Self is Atman.
Self doesn't have the headache. As the Atma, self doesn't have the headache, but I say I have a headache. Whereas the true statement is my head is hurting. But it's a paradigm shift, you know. You have to kind of think in those terms. Right? So instead of saying that I have a broken shoulder, it's my shoulder that's broken. Isolating the two.
It's like not identifying with, like, you don't say, I have diabetes, because then you're identifying that you are diabetes.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what it is saying.
What is it? Come again.
So rather than saying, I have diabetes, because that's identifying yourself as diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
My body has diabetes.
My body is diseased.
My body is diseased. Yeah. We're separating ourselves from the body, mind, and the intellect. That's the whole purpose eventually. Okay. So avidya is not to have that ability to separate the two. That's avidya. That's ignorance. Okay. Impure. The body is impure. Ever look at the inside of the body? That same thing that I was talking about. Excretions, blood, sweat, urine, feces, everything. Okay. Rope versus snake example.
So in this section, it's talking about the thought that the body is a temple that can be used for the service of God.
Uh-huh.
So this is the opposite of that,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because it's not pure.
Well, whatever it is, right, whether it's inside it's pure or not, outside it's pure, but if we can treat that as a temple of God, because in our scriptures they say that the soul, which is also a part of this whole being, it's a part of this whole system. Okay? So it's a temple in that sense, because now we are treating this whole being as a temple.
But it's a dirty temple.
It's a dirty temple.
But you have to clean that.
It's the only one we got.
Yeah.
But that's all we got, right? Okay, so everyone knows the rope versus snake example? Why? Everyone aware of that, right?
Yeah.
Rope as a snake, yeah. And that's because of the dull light. That's ignorance. Dull light represents ignorance. When somebody throws light on it, which is knowledge, then you get rid of that ignorance. Okay, so that was an understanding of what avidya or ignorance is. Then the next one is asmita. Okay? So the Sanskrit is drik darshana shaktyoho ekatmata eva asmita. Asmita, asmita, asmita. Okay? Now, this is where, you know, you have to get into the philosophy of Sankhya, because this is what it is. Okay? I'm trying to see what's the best way of introducing this concept here. The word drik means the one who sees, sort of, drik. And darshana is what is seen. Okay, so what it's saying is that when ekatmata means oneness, when you begin to treat the one who is seeing and the one that is being seen, when you see those two powers as one, that is ego, asmita.
That is ego?
Yes, asmita. When you are seeing two things which are supposedly separate, the atma, the soul is separate from the body and mind, but when you start seeing them together, that's ego. Because now ego is being identified as the main doer, is the main soul. Ego says, I'm everything. I don't care about anything else. I know exactly what I'm doing. I will do it that way. I'll dominate you. I'll dominate that person. You are stupid. I can control you. I can do that. So ego is taken over. And that's because we have allowed the ekatmata or oneness between what are the two entities that should be separate. Drik and Darshana. This is the pure Sankhya philosophy now here. Okay, that's exactly what's in the Sankhya. If you read the Sankhya philosophy, that's all they talk about. What is this Atma? What is the soul? And why and how it is separate from the rest of the entity, which is the mind, body, intellect and everything else. But we have, because of that avidya that we talked about, not understanding the difference between the Atma and the non-Atma. Because of that, we have now projected our ego to be the representative of that Atma. Alright.
So this is not counter to the philosophy where our soul is one with Ishvara or with God, right? That we...
It's not counter to that, but it doesn't mention it here. Patanjali does not mention anything beyond our own individual soul and the rest of the material aspect.
You know how we talked about that we are not separate, though, from that?
From what?
That we, right? You know what I'm talking about? We talked about not being separate from Ishvara.
Ishvara is a concept, like I said, Patanjali's Ishvara is a slightly different concept compared to the Ishvara concept in, for example, Vedanta philosophy. He has used it for a purpose. Okay? He doesn't want to mess up with all the other Vedantic concepts because his purpose is limited and he wants to keep it just within that kind of a narrow framework. Okay? When we go into other aspects of the Indian philosophy, where Vedanta is a prime example, where there's individual soul, then there is Ishvara, and there's another entity called Brahman, which is the one individual supreme consciousness. Now, I don't want to, that's why I never mention Vedanta concept, because we get confused. There is a difference in understanding Vedanta concepts compared to the yoga concepts. So I would like to stay within the framework of Patanjali's yoga.
So that's saying that the soul is separate from the physical body.
Yes,
and
yes,
the mind.
Yes. So in the concept of yoga or in the concept of Sankhya, these are two totally separate entities. And they are both real, they are both permanent, they are both, they are both called anadi. Anadi means they are beginningless, both of them.
Both which are
both what?
Purusha and Prakriti.
Oh, I thought the seer.
Seer is Purusha.
Purusha.
And what is seen is Prakriti. And they are two independent entities, but they need each other for their function.
That makes sense.
But did he mention about Prakriti and Purusha here? Because, like what I understood, I am this ear, and you are the same. And it, like, you know, I feel like, you know, we both have the same soul. That is oneness. So that is against egoism. But here in this sutra, he didn't mention about, it's about Prakriti and Purusha, just like, you know, it's a general sutra, the seer
no. Seen. Seer seen, the meaning is Prakriti and Purusha. That's the meaning. This is all derived from the Sankhya philosophy. When you say Drik Darshana, that implies that he's talking about Purusha and Prakriti. It's not about my seeing somebody else. It's all about me. That's everything is. Patanjali's focus is me, individual.
And these terms have different understandings in Vedanta?
Some of these terms do, yes.
Okay.
Like Ishvara has a different understanding in Vedanta. Yes, slightly different.
Okay. When you read this stuff, they don't often tell you which philosophy is coming out of.
Well, that's because those people, when you read these, this stuff, it comes from a person who is fully engrossed in one philosophy. He doesn't care about the others.
I see. It's not comparative.
It's not comparative in that sense. So he is only focusing on his concept, for example.
You have to know.
What school he is coming from.
Yes,
you have to know what school he's coming from.
So this sutra says, the seer is not the seen.
Yes. But the fact that they are considered the same, that's ego. That's what the whole definition of asmita is. That it's the ekatmata. Ekatmata means that sense of being one. Oneness of the seer and the seen. Oneness of Purusha and Prakriti. Oneness of the ego, thinking of itself as the main being, that's the ego part, asmita part.
But in yoga philosophy, there's Purusha and
union of body and soul.
I forgot one. The question is it the same? Is it part of Ishvara?
See, Ishvara has been defined as a Purusha Vishesha in Sanskrit. Purusha Vishesha means a special Purusha. Okay, it's not a part of it. It's not an entity taken from it. It's a special Purusha which has special characteristics. Okay, Ishvara has been defined as having special characteristics. Okay, so the characteristics that we discussed were Klesha, Karma, Vipaka, Ashayahi, Aparam. I'm just giving you the Sanskrit phrase first. Klesha, karma, vipaka, ashayahi, aparamrishtaha. That means, on the one hand, we have this Purusha, which, my individual soul, which because of its identification with the Prakriti, with the body and mind and the ego, okay, it goes through Klesha, it goes through the suffering, this joint entity of Purusha and the material being considered together, it goes through suffering because we have Klesha, we go through karma, we go through the result of karma, we have a bag of karmas which we carry from one life to the other, and then some of these will bring fruits in this life, some of these will bring fruit in the next life in form of where you are born, how far your lifespan would be, what kind of experiences you will have in life, all those things are coming up now in the next few sutras. But all those are defined.
Is Purusha the witness then?
Yes. Purusha is the witness. He is the seer. He is the one that's watching. That's why it's called the drik.
This concept is just about ourselves, that the Purusha and the Prakriti are separate, but it doesn't from the philosophy that we all have Purusha within us.
No, everyone has Purusha, right?
Okay, that's where I think I was missing it, right? That we all have Purusha.
See, that's the basic distinction between Vedanta and yoga. In yoga, every individual is an individual Purusha. In Vedanta, there is one soul. Everything is an element of the same one single soul. That's Vedanta. That's why I don't want to get confused, okay? Vedanta concepts are different from what we are talking about.
I think it makes sense to me now, though, that's what we're saying, that everyone has Purusha within them, and that's why we are not separate from others. But for ourselves, we are separate from the Purusha and the Prakriti.
That's right.
Yoga is derived from a word, a Sanskrit word, Yaju. Yaju is nothing but union of your soul and body.
So no,
that
no,
is
no,
the
no.
philosophy of the yoga.
No, where do you read that?
I read somewhere.
Show me where it is, then I can explain that. It's not in Patanjali's yoga. That's not you. If you have read it somewhere, show it to me where it is, so I can, we can, you know, understand what that is. Bring it in. In chapter 2, we are going to read that here. Yoga, if you think of yoga as the union between the soul and the body, that he says, but that Patanjali says, that is the sole reason why we are suffering in this whole universe. We'll come to that.
That's, suffering?
Because we are thinking of this body and soul as the same.
Oh.
And that's what he said. That yoga comes from the main word yuj, which means to join together. And he says that he read somewhere that joining together means that it's the union of the mind and body and the soul, which is yoga, which is exactly opposite of what Patanjali is telling us. Just the opposite.
Don't confuse me.
I read it, I'll bring it. I'm very firm on that.
Yeah, please
and
bring
also
it.
I've been in the same assumption all these days.
Please bring it in. And so, no, it may be in a different context. What you've read may be in a different context. Not in the context of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. In a different context, like I said, in the context of Vedanta, all that makes sense. In the context of Vedanta, everything is one. Everything is one. Right? So if you are coming from that Vedantic school, then what you're saying makes sense. But when we go to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and try to understand that, you have to look at it from his perspective.
Which school came first, yoga or Vedanta?
Almost simultaneous.
Interestingly, Bhagavad Gita supports both.
It gets confusing sometimes, but you know, you just have to start kind of filtering out those in messages that don't belong here. Okay? So there are six philosophies, right? Six philosophical streams. And yoga and Sankhya, they are kind of treated as in one group. Then there is Vaisheshika and Nyaya. Those are the two schools which are kind of treated together. They are logic and, you know, thinking of the elements and all that good stuff. Okay, so that Nyaya and Vaisheshika, then Sankhya and Yoga, and then Vedanta and Mimamsa. Okay, so these are the six school of thought which are not too far in terms of time frame. They are not too far apart from each other. Sankhya is the oldest. Sankhya is the first one to be stated by Kapila. You know, he was the author. And then many of the concepts of Sankhya has been taken by all these five other philosophies. But then some of them have been modified, changed. So Vedanta took a very different approach.
You get tied up in that stuff and it doesn't really matter, I don't think. You know? I think you can get caught up in that kind of stuff and you're taking yourself away from the...
That's why, you know, whenever we discuss Yoga Sutras, we like to keep everything else away from us for now. Once we have a very good and deep understanding of the Yoga Sutras, then you go into other things and you probably will understand everything better then. But stay with one for the time being.
I think it makes sense now with the distinction of Purusha and Prakriti within ourselves are different, but that each, we're still all connected by the Purushas within each other.
Well, it's
we're
not,
similar, everyone has
a similar, yeah, it's a very similar concept then, yes. Okay. So, that's the Sankhya philosophy, and we'll, like I said, in this whole chapter, there's much more of Sankhya philosophy and Karma philosophy, and we'll come to that slowly as we discuss these things. So, egoism, the definition according to, I'm assuming this is from the same book, is the identification, as it were, of the power of the seer, Purusha, with that of the instrument of seeing, which is the body and mind. That's what we just said. Okay? Drigdarshana shaktyoho ekatmata eva. Okay? As if. Eva means as if. As if these two are together. That means we are implying that these two are together. That's asmita. That's egoism.
How is that first, the first word pronounced?
Is druk? Druk. Well, if you're from southern part or the western part of India, you'll pronounce it as druk. If you're from where I am from, we pronounce it as drik. Regional differences. How do you pronounce it?
Druk.
Druk. So from southern and the western part of India, they pronounce it as druk. And rest of India pronounces it as drik.
But the G has a k sound.
No, no.
Okay. I see it.
No. G. That is a rule of the grammar rule. The K gets converted to G when you combine with the next letter. That's Sandhi, it's called Sandhi rule. The word is Drik with a K. But when you combine it with the Darshana of the following letter, or for the following word, then that K gets converted to G.
Oh, I see.
These are the translation, that the rule of joining words that are together. It's called Sandhi rules in Sanskrit.
Oh, it's a Sanskrit rule.
Yeah.
The Sanskrit
it's a
rule.
Grammar rule,
yes. The rule of the Sanskrit grammar, yep.
It's the next lifetime. Understanding Sanskrit for me.
Yeah. I've been learning Sanskrit for a while now, so, you know, at least some of the basics, I get to get a feel for it now.
I'll be happy if I can pronounce the words.
Hmm?
I'll be happy if I can pronounce the
right,
words.
Right.
I was happy to learn that the A prefix meant opposite. Right, so that when the A is in front of the word, that it means has the opposite
meaning. Like Vidya. Vidya is knowledge, and we add the letter A in front of Vidya, that means lack of knowledge.
Oh, okay.
But sometimes we use A in the past tense also in Sanskrit.
That depends on the context, right? He's also learning Sanskrit. He's in Sanskrit class. Okay. So what is asmita? Difference, so I have given some explanation here. It's the difference between capital I and small I. So the capital I and small I, the difference is a dot. Okay, then dot is a blemish. Blemish is ignorance. Okay. So if you remove the ignorance, you become capital I, which is the Purusha. And then we are the original I, it says. The power of seeing, hearing, etc. comes because of the power of Purusha, but we mistakenly identify it with the sense objects or the mind, etc. That's what we've been talking about all along. Okay, next is raga. That's the next klesha, raga. So the definition is sukhanushayi. Ragaha. Sukhanushayi ragaha. Ragaha. Okay. Alright. So, sukh means pleasure, happiness. Sukh means, you know, all that's good. Anushayi means something that follows something. Okay. So, if you have a pleasant experience, you know, if I always take that example, if I eat a piece of cake or an ice cream and it's a pleasant experience, I like it and I have a desire to have it again, then I get attached to it. That's raga. Okay? Getting attached to something because of a pleasant experience, okay, and then having that desire to have that experience over and over again, that's raga. Okay? So, attachment. Right? We get attached to everything, money, family, house, property, whatever, you know. Just because it gives some pleasant experience and we want to have that repeat experience.
It says that the ego precedes attachment, but that's because the ego attached the label, right?
Mm-hmm. So that's the label that, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, every experience creates a memory in us, every experience. Pleasant or unpleasant, doesn't matter, right? Every experience creates a memory, but then the ego attaches two labels to it. One label is whether the experience was pleasant or unpleasant, whether it was good or bad, whether we liked it or disliked it, etc. That's one label. And the second label is a desire whether we want a repeat of that experience or not. Okay? So there are two Sanskrit names for all these. One is pure memory, you know, which is the actual stuff that happened as you saw it. That's called memory or the smriti. Then the second part, when we put the label, likes or dislikes, that's raga and dvesha, which is the, you know, the label whether we liked it or we didn't like it, whether we loved it or hated it. And then third is the desire to have that experience over and over again. That's called vasana in Sanskrit. So there's samskara. There's memory, likes and dislikes are samskaras, and then vasana. So these are the three different things in Sanskrit. So if we have a pleasant experience, then we get attached to that. And the opposite is dukkhanushayi dveshaha. Dukkhanushayi dveshaha. Alright? So dukkha means pain, suffering, that's dukkha. And again, anushayi, you know, when we have that experience, it's followed, attached to that. Then that becomes dvesha. Dvesha means animosity, hatred, dislike, all those negative things. So we start identifying with those painful experiences and then we become hateful or, you know, we don't like them. All right.
But what he's saying, though, with those two is we should never not be attracted to one, nor have aversion to any experience. It's,
right.
We're detached
right.
from both, right?
Eventually, yes.
Yes.
That's the goal. Because once we recognize that this is being done by the ego, this attachment to to something pleasant and dislike of something unpleasant. It's done by the ego. And when we recognize that the ego is caused by the avidya or ignorance of not knowing the reality, everything is clear then. And we have no attachment to anything then. Once we recognize all that.
Each experience is a new experience, right?
Each experience is a new experience as long as you can relate it to the pure part of the memory. Okay? So, you know, if I'm looking at you, the only reason I know that you are Kathy is because I have in my memory your face with the label Kathy. Okay, I need that for my survival. Right? So I can work in my life. So that part of the memory is absolutely required. But that's the pure memory without any label. Now, the moment I look at Kathy and become angry because I had a label there, unpleasant, that's the part I don't want. I want to get rid of that part. Okay? I want the pure memory part because otherwise I cannot survive. I cannot live.
And you get rid of that part by just practice, through practice?
Through practice of the 8 limbs of yoga. That's what Patanjali told us. That if you practice 8 limbs of yoga, then you will become free of the all these negative influences of the ego, and you will dispel that whole concept of avidya or the ignorance that you are attached or identified with the ego, and then you become your pure self, pure Purusha. When you recognize that you, in this case, my buddhi, my intellect, my ego, everything is separate from Purusha. I am the Purusha. And I have all this instrumentation of the mind and body so I can gain the experiences of this life, I'm good to go. That's when I'm fully liberated. All I want to do is to understand that I am pure Purusha. I'm not involved with anything, but I have this material entity called the mind and body and the intellect, which I enjoy having this because it gives me life's experiences. And all that is mentioned in the sutras that are coming up.
So if somebody does that to us, so we label him like we want to stay from the person. But in this context, like if he comes back to us, and do we want to stay away or just get rid of like, you know, that label and say, okay,
No. Again, The point that we have always talked about this, the label could be created either with your pure intellect or it could be created by the ego. Okay? Now, that's the subtle distinction that we have to start making. Who created the label? If it was created by the ego, I don't want to look at it. But it was created by the intellect, pure intellect, without any involvement of the ego. I want to look at that label. Because I want to live my life, right?
But how do you know whether it's made by ego or intellect?
Through practice. Through the practice of 8 limbs of yoga. That's when Patanjali said that by the practice of these 8 limbs of yoga, your intellect will shine through with a bright light. Deepti, jnana deepti. Remember that shloka? That through the practices of 8 limbs of yoga, you know, your impurities will be gone. Your impurities caused by the ego will be gone. And jnana deepti, that means your light of knowledge will shine through and your pure intuitive wisdom will come through. And then you will know exactly who's making that label. Whether it is done by the ego or whether it is done by the intellect. Until then, we are confused. And that's why we are suffering. So when that confusion disappears, then we know who is making that label. If it is done by the pure intellect, I won't use it. Absolutely.
So since yoga is similar to Buddhism's Four Noble Truths for removing suffering.
Yeah. So there's parallel here also. They're the same terms used in Buddhism's Four Noble Truths. Patanjali uses the same term. heya hetuhu, heya hetuhu, etc. You know, they are the same terms used in Buddhism also. See? There is suffering, then there is the cause for suffering, then there is a way to remove the suffering, and then there is a whole process of how it is done. Okay? And the process in Buddhism also is called the Eightfold Path. Eightfold Path is Buddhism, Eightfold Path in the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. Okay? Very identical. That's why many people believe that either one of them, you know, they were very close to each other, but who came first and who came after, they don't know. Because they seem to have been influenced by each other. Okay? There are many concepts which are very similar. Some of the terms are very similar between Buddhism and Patanjali.
I feel like if you have the question of who applied the label, then that's pretty telling. Right? If you really don't know, then you can justify
everything. You're absolutely right. Good statement. If you have that doubt, that means ego is playing a role in there to create that doubt. So, no, that's, you know, it's something that comes with a lot of self-analysis and, you know, eight limbs of yoga. You have to really apply those eight limbs of yoga, and then only you start getting a little bit of clarity in your thinking, you know, clarity of understanding who does that labeling. Okay? So if somebody does, you know, harm to you, first of all, you have to recognize whether that understanding, that feeling is coming by the ego or from the intellect. Okay? If the ego is making that label that this guy is an idiot, he has harmed me, maybe it was not intended that way, but just took it that way. Who knows? If the ego doesn't do anything very clearly, you know, it just messes up everything. Okay? So that's where the clarity will, you know, really play a role. Sometimes the ego might say, this guy is trying to do harm to me. Intellect will come back and say, no, it's nothing. It's nothing. It's okay. We go through all these things in life. Right? Same situation, somebody will feel very threatened by the same situation, the other person will say nothing, it's okay. That's because his ego is not involved. That's how you start kind of analyzing. That's why I always say, you know, do this exercise at least for 10 days and you will love it. At the end of every day, before you go to sleep, pick out three of the most significant events of the day and identify whether the ego was involved or the intellect was involved. Do it every day for 10 days. You learn so much about yourself. That's the best way to self-analyze. Do it every day. You'll be amazed how much you learn from that experience, from this exercise. Okay? So that's the raga and dvesha. And then finally, there's a statement from Bhagavad Gita which I like, you know. It talks about anger. Anger is also caused by dislike and all that, dvesha, right? So he says, unfulfilled desires cause anger which can lead to total destruction. Okay, there's a very beautiful shloka in Bhagavad Gita. In fact, there are two of them, and someday we'll go through that in detail. All right. So the Sanskrit is swarasavahi vidushopi tatharudhah abhinivesha. There's something missing in the Sanskrit here, which is okay. Okay. So abhinivesha is the desire to cling to life for the fear of death. Basically, fear of change. So what it's saying is, that clinging to life, and I'm using Satchidananda's translation here, clinging to life, flowing by its own potency due to past experiences, exists even in the wise people. Vidusha. Vidusha means one who has attained wisdom. To a large extent, who has gotten rid of the ego, even he is scared of death. That's what he's saying. That's abhinivesha. Even they have this desire to maintain status quo. So everything starts from fear, basically. Fear of change. Fear of death. We are afraid of everything, basically. Every change brings about a fear in life. Every change. Every potential change brings fear. If you don't have a job, there's a fear whether I'm going to get a job. If you have a job, you're always afraid, maybe I'll lose the job. If I'm married, you know, if I'm not married, I have a fear when I'm going to get married. If I'm married, then you know, I have this question, when I'm going to get rid of this person.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so there's always that sense of fear. And that comes from raga and dvesha. That fear comes from that attachment and dislike, raga and dvesha that we talked about. Fear is a result of that. Okay? If you like something, you're attached to it and you're always afraid, am I going to lose it? If you dislike something, you dislike it so much and then you're always afraid, when am I going to get rid of this? Right? One moment, the same entity, you like it so much, oh boy, my God, I hope I don't lose it. The next moment, the same entity becomes hateful. Oh my God, when am I going to get rid of this person? Yeah. Every day it changes. We go through this whole ebb and flow of love and hate in life with everything, including humans, including our life partners. It happens all the time. Children, our possessions, everything. We go through that. Fear. Fear is the mother of all problems. Okay, and then it's caused by raga and dvesha. Raga and dvesha is caused by ego. Ego is caused by avidya or ignorance.
What causes ignorance?
Ignorance is beginningless. We are born with it. There's only one entity which is beginningless but has an end to it. Avidya, ignorance, can be eliminated through the practice of yoga. It's one of the entities that Prakriti brings with it. Avidya. So avidya is the only entity, that's what I've read. That's the only entity which is beginningless but has an end to it. Purusha and Prakriti are both beginningless and endless. Anadi, Ananta, those are the two words used. Whereas, avidya is anadi but not ananta. So that's abhinivesha, fear of death. Oh, I have an example of your security alarm system. It is our fear of loss, death, that we put the alarm system in. People use all kinds of security alarms and this and that, but things still happen, right? You know, when we moved to our house, when we were living in New Jersey, and we moved to a house where they had already a built-in alarm system. You know, the system was built-in, so we said, all right, keep it, what the hell. And so one day, you know, we had gone out for a late night party and we came back at midnight. When we came back, we saw, you know, two police cars in front of our house and a lot of people there. And you know, what happened? Your security alarm sent a signal to the police department. It went off. So we all went in, you know, carefully, nothing. Perfectly normal house. So So something triggered that alarm. I just pulled the alarm out and threw it away in the garbage can. I don't need any alarm system. You know, who's going to, you know, it's okay. If things happen, they happen. Accept them. And this is a nuisance, this alarm system. Yeah. So I just took it out and threw it in the garbage. I said, I don't want it. But then people get fearful. I always, you know, I like to tell the story of my friend in New Jersey. We used to play tennis together, one of my very close tennis buddies. And we used to play in the morning, 6 o'clock every morning, 3 to 4 times a week. So in the winter, it used to be snow and all that. So everybody would like to park as close to the entrance door as possible, right? This guy, he bought a new Mercedes car, and he would park half a mile away in the snow, in the last parking lot, so that nobody could touch his car. And then he would walk in that 1 foot of snow up to the entrance door. And 6 months later, this guy stopped coming. We didn't see him for almost 10, 15 days. I don't know what's happening. And I called him up one day, you know, said, look, you know, we were scheduled to play. I never heard from you. What happened to you? He says, I had an accident. My car got totaled. This guy is devastated. Why? Because he's so attached to his car. He wants to park it half a mile away. And now it's totaled, and he's in a state of mourning for 10, 15 days. Cannot get out of it. You know, so I always come back to that example because it's amazing how people get attached to these things. Bhagavad Gita says there's a statement that just as we discard old clothes and get new ones, our soul also discards old, worn out, dead bodies and then gets into a new body. That's the whole concept of reincarnation. And we'll come to that later. Gail is not happy with that.
Well, I don't think he really get rid of it. I mean, I think you come back with your karma.
Maybe
you burn off some this lifetime.
That's right.
The next one.
Yeah, yeah. When we say soul comes back, soul is always attached with the karma. So what comes back is the soul with a bag full of karma with it. You're right. Okay. So, let's do this last one, and I think we'll stop off. I'm getting kind of tired. So, te, that's the first word, te.
Te.
Prati prasava heyaha. Sukshmaha. So, te prati prasava heyaha sukshmaha.
They means helps to know, it's good, I guess.
Hmm?
It helps to know the language.
Yeah, it does help. Yeah, absolutely. That's the reason I learned Sanskrit, because I want to study these things in its original language. All right. Otherwise, you're stuck with translations from others. And if you read 5 translations, they'll all be different. Sometimes their interpretations are different. Sometimes they're even opposite to each other. So unless you have your own understanding and interpretation, you never know what that commentator meant. Okay. So, what does that mean? Prasava is to give birth. Okay? Pratiprasava would mean literally to put back something back into the womb. All right. So bring something back to its origin, to its source. Okay. Now, what that means is that these afflictions, these kleshas, can be burnt away. Heya means they can be removed, they can be burnt away in their very subtle form if you can take them back to their origin. All right. Now, again, we're going back to the concept of Sankhya here. This is a pure Sankhya concept. All right. What it means is, I'm going to have to spend 5 minutes just explaining that concept of Sankhya. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't make probably much sense. So when we talk of Purusha and Prakriti, Prakriti is the material aspect or the this concept of mind, body and intellect. Now what they claim is that at the beginning of this whole creation, this Prakriti is in a state of balance and it's unmanifest. It's just pure entity by itself without any manifestation of the mind, body and intellect, etc. That happens because there are three gunas. Anybody, everyone familiar with the three gunas? What are these? Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. Purity, action, and dullness, you can call it. Sattva, Rajas and Tamas. Everything in this nature, everything in the universe is a composite of these three gunas. Everything. These three gunas. In some balance, in some proportion. When they are in perfect balance, and we don't know what that balance means, but when they are in perfect balance, there is no manifestation. There is no physical manifestation. There is no material manifestation. Then everything is in its unmanifest form. Okay? And that's called the source of everything. Manifestation happens because the guna rajas somehow becomes a little more dominant, because rajas means activity. It creates activity and then it creates its creation. And this creation at the physical, at the individual level is the human being or individual living beings. Not just the human being, all living beings, that's at the individual level. At the cosmic level, it's the whole universe. This entire universe is also a part of the same creation. There is a cosmic counterpart and there is a individual counterpart. All right, and this is a whole different philosophy, you know, which is very hard to understand for me. Okay, but that's the material aspect of unmanifest being, which is called Prakriti. It's called Mula Prakriti. That's the term they use. Mula means root, base. Okay, so the whole purpose of the practice of yoga is to eventually create a balance among these three gunas so that we can go back to Mula Prakriti. We can transcend these limited ego, mind, body, complex elements and go back to our original source, which is the balanced, unmanifest Mula Prakriti.
And the three gunas are what again? Dullness?
Sattva is purity, sattva, S-A-T-T-V-A, sattva, purity. Then rajas, R-A-J-A-S, which is action, activity. And tamas, T-A-M-A-S, which is dullness, negativity stuff and all that. All the bad stuff. Dullness, you can say. Sleepiness, couch potato-ness, you know. That's tamas. And this applies to everything. It applies to material objects. It applies to human body. the physical body, it applies to our thoughts, it applies to our feelings, it applies to things that we do. Bhagavad Gita, for example, has a huge description of these three gunas in multiple aspects. Okay. If you have read, anybody read Bhagavad Gita? No. But there's a very strong component of the description of these gunas in there. Okay. In fact, I'm in the process of compiling just a document which lists all the shlokas from Bhagavad Gita which relate to the description of these gunas. In no particular order, but just I'm just picking everything that talks about gunas and I'm putting it in one document. I'm working on it now. Just for my own reference, you know. Not sure what it's going to be used for, but...
To share with us.
I can share with anybody, as long as you can make some use of it or some sense of it. But before I do that, I'll need to make some sense out of it myself, you know. Why am I doing it? I don't know. No, I've had this feeling for a while that, you know, there is so much discussion on the gunas. Let me isolate all the shlokas and then see if I can, you know, put something out of it, you know, do some analysis of it, you know.
Yeah,
guna is everywhere. Guna is a part of all discussions, whether it is Sankhya, whether it is Yoga, or whether it is Vedanta, guna is everywhere. That's the basic element of everything. Every text talks about it. Every text. Okay. So what this sutra is saying is that these kleshas can be eliminated by taking them back to their source, which is Mula Prakriti. That means you eliminate the influence of this identification with the body, mind, ego, etc. When you can do that and you can create a perfect balance between the three gunas, the kleshas will disappear. Then they will kind of merge back into its own source. Then they don't exist anymore. Now you have identified yourself with the pure I-ness, pure being. There's no more klesha after that. So at the subtlest level, sukshma means subtle level, you can bring them back to the source and then get rid of them. That's the whole concept of te prati prasavaheyaha sukshmaha. And that means you have been able to identify or de-identify them from this mind-body complex.
Sort of seems like an abstract concept to me.
It is very abstract. Some of these are, you really have to contemplate on these concepts a lot before you begin to make any sense out of them. I have, you know, I've spent time on these and I cannot say I understand them thoroughly. I mean, it's very intellectual even now, you know. But I'm working on it. It's work in progress. It's always going to be just trying to understand these concepts.
I still don't understand how you take the klesha back to its source.
Well, you know, the way you do that is analyze one by one. Abhinivesha, fear. Fear is caused by the raga and dvesha, by the attachment and dislikes, likes and dislikes. Okay? What is causing the likes and dislikes? Asmita, ego. What's causing the ego? Ego is caused by the avidya. Avidya is ignorance. Ignorance of identifying what is impure with the pure, what is unreal with the real, what is non-atma with the non-soul with the soul. That's avidya. Once we get rid of that, then you have now identified yourself with the pure soul, okay, and the material essence of our prakriti has now gotten into a state where the gunas are balanced, and they have come to a state where there is perfect balance into the mula state. So we have merged these whole concepts of abhinivesha, raga, dvesha, etc. into their source, which is the mula prakriti. And then we have got rid of them. It's a deep concept. It's not easy.
like it also is a continuous process, right?
It is, yes, yes. Yeah. It has to be done on a continuous basis, right?
Okay.